Thanks, Daniele. And thanks everyone who's here for this talk. So I'm going to talk about how we get to derive some effective line elements in loop quantum gravity. This was mostly done in this paper with Martin and Dong Han, and based on some previous work and something else that we are also working on. Okay. So I'll first give you the brief motivation, which is that so canonical quantization techniques often leads to new effects in quantum gravity, and they're both in the dynamics as well as in the structure of space-time. And usually the first effects that are noticed lie in how classical dynamical equations are modified due to, let's say, some background independent quantizations. And as an example, and a famous example now of this effective Friedman equation in isotropic and homogeneous loop quantum cosmology, where the classical Friedman equation is modified with this term here in red. And this is quite a remarkable deviation from classical dynamics because it ends up giving us singularity resolution. And where it originates from is really, but if we go back and see where it originates from, it's of course from the Hamiltonian constraint of that system. So the LQG Hamiltonian constraint in this case receives some regularizations, which makes it different from the usual classical GR Hamiltonian constraint. So the main question which I would like to ask is, once you introduce this kind of corrections to the Hamiltonian constraint, let's say, we know that it results in some quite drastic modifications to the dynamical equations, like here, but can it also change the structure of space-time rather drastically? So what effects basically do these same quantum corrections have on the structure of space-time? And one way of looking at this problem is something which I have been doing for, let's say, a couple of years, is to look at how the symmetries of space-time are deformed once you introduce such corrections. But that is not the point of view which I'm going to talk about today, but rather this, let's say, more physical consequence of, if I want to derive invariant line elements which are consistent with such changes, what do I end up getting? And do they somehow signal to us in a clean, clear way that the structures of space-time are indeed strongly modified due to corrections coming, let's say, from loop quantum gravity? Okay, so as already mentioned, I'm going to work in this canonical approach to loop quantum gravity. And here, unlike in the Lagrangian formulation, you split up space-time into foliations. This is all known to us. And now the usual space-time metric can be written in terms of this ADM metric, and there's a nice one-to-one correspondence between these two. However, the roles that these Lagrange multipliers, the laps and the shift play, is somewhat different from what the role that the spatial metric QAB on these hypersurfaces play. And we shall see that explicitly in a while. So again, because when I try to do Hamiltonian gravity, it's, you can write it down as a sum of the scalar constraint and the spatial diffeomorphism constraint. And of course, on shell, it is trivial, which signals that there's no absolute concept of time in GR. But these first-class constraints play a dual role here. And they're first-class in the nomenclature of Dirac because they close into an algebra. And these first-class constraints play a dual role. For example, if I want, they generate the equations of motion for the system once I choose for a given choice of this Lagrange multiplier. So for these laps and shift, when I choose, make a given choice, then in that particular gauge, I can derive the equations of motion as generated by these constraints. But these same constraints also generate gauge transformations, which do not change the physical solutions. So this sort of embodies the fact that there is a freedom in the choice of time. So the form of both sets of equations are, of course, very similar because they're generated by the same constraints, but their meaning is rather different. And we shall see this explicitly a little later. And just looking ahead, so this is all, of course, classical GR, but looking ahead, so what happens if I introduce modifications from loop quantum gravity into these constraints? Well, it would be crucial to understand this interplay between gauge and evolution. And a consistent interplay between these equations of motions and gauge transformations shall rely on this off-shell algebra of the constraints, in the case of LQG, of the modified constraints. And of course, I shall make these statements more concrete as we go on. So what is this algebra? So again, this is classical GR. In this case, this Dirac algebra, hypersurface deformation algebra, is given by, so these are the generators of spatial diffeomorphisms or spatial deformations, and H are the generators of normal deformations to the hypersurface. And as you can see, these constraints indeed close into each other, but they don't form a Lie algebra, they form an algebraic, because there's some structure functions appearing here instead of structure constants. So the inverse of the spatial metric appears in one of these relations, which is illustrated here. So how we take the order in which we take the this normal deformations matter, and this is given by a spatial deformation on the spatial hypersurface. Okay, so this is all very well known, and invariance under this algebra implies not general covariance. So this is indeed the algebra also for higher curvature theories and so on, and not just GR. And also there is this uniqueness result that if you start with from this algebra and you restrict yourself to second order field equations, one uniquely gets back Einstein's equations up to the cosmological constant. So let me anticipate a little bit more. So this is a result which I just quote here, and I shall show you explicitly what I mean later, is that once I work with these modified constraints, which include this loop quantum gravity corrections, they still form a closed algebra. And therefore, we don't have any sort of anomalies, which would be gauge anomalies in this case. But indeed, there are deformations which appear in this algebra. And that shall play a crucial role when I go on to derive the line element for such systems. Okay, so why is it important that this modified constraints still form a closed algebra? Is because, so the phase space, of course, here is given by the spatial metric and its conjugate momenta. And this algebra is calculated as the Poisson algebra of these constraints on this phase space, classically. So in canonical gravity, these gauge transformations represent coordinate freedom. So if I have some phase space function, then its space-timely derivative is given by the gauge transformations generated by these constraints. And I've chosen the time direction like this. And this is why it's important that the algebra of constraints close and do not give rise to any anomalies, because this represents coordinate freedom. Then we would lose coordinate freedom for whatever effective or modified theory that one is studying. And this is what I meant by that they have a very similar structure, both the gauge transformations and the equations of motion, and they are generated by the same set of constraints. But what we now require is a commutation property, that the evolution of gauge transformed initial data must equal the gauge transformation of evolved initial data. And because we want a commutation property, that's why this relies on the interplay between, this interplay between gauge and evolution relies on the Dirac algebra. Because there's a commutation, because we want a commutation property, so that we will end up with some Poisson brackets between these constraints. And that we can read off from the Dirac algebra. Okay, so this is all classical, well understood. And for the LQG scenario, once these constraints are modified, the story that changes here is, of course, that the constraints themselves are modified, but also that this algebra now gets deformed. And that would play a crucial role in this interplay between evolution and gauge. So before we go on to calculate the line element for LQG, there's a small puzzle which we need to first resolve, which is that these gauge transformations, which are generated by these constraints, act only on the spatial metric, but not on these Lagrange multipliers. And this is what I meant earlier by that they have a somewhat different role. However, for a generic coordinate transformation, of course, it can change the QABs, but also the time and space, the mixed components of the metric. So how do we account for that? How do we account for the transformations that this lapse and shift must satisfy? So there are two ways of solving this. One is to consider the extended phase space, which has the primary constraints are not solved. And this was done by these gentlemen. Or we can require that the canonical equations of motion are gauge covariant. So this is the approach which we are going to take, because this shows more explicitly the crucial role played by the Dirac algebra. So once again, once we can show this for the classical case, exactly how to get the transformations for N and NA, we can then extend the results once this algebra gets deformed for loop on gravity. Okay, so how do I derive this is, we look at the canonical equations of motion in a particular gauge, and they must transform properly with the gauge transformations that are generated by the same constraints. And this is possible only if this Lagrange multipliers transform in a particular way. So from now on, I'm just going to use this index, capital A and capital B's, to represent all of the Lagrange multipliers and the constraints, just to simplify notation. So let's say we have some phase space variable, and we know how its evolution goes. We know the evolution equation for it. And then we introduce some coordinate transform, like so. And this transformation is, again, generated by the same constraint. And we know how this is defined. I mean, this is the definition of the transformation. Now, if the transformed Q also has to satisfy the same form of the equations of motion, that requires that these multipliers appearing here must transform in a particular way. So this is the transformation that I just define it to be this. And using the constraint algebra, so and equating the left-hand sides and the right-hand sides separately, so you can calculate the left-hand sides by plugging in this in here and using these equations and the right-hand side separately, we can calculate exactly what these transformations must be for the constraints, for the multipliers. Okay, so let's say I have some constraint algebra, and these are my structure functions. In that case, of course, for GR, some of these are, indices are continuous indices because they're integrated over. So that would mean that these Lagrange multipliers must transform in this way, so that the form of these equations remains gauge covariant. Explicitly for gravity, one can derive what these transformations should be for the lapse and the shift. And this, the transformation of the lapse depends on the H with D bracket, so the bracket between the Hamiltonian constraint and the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, whereas the transformation of the shift depends on the D with D bracket and the H with H bracket. And I've put the Qij up here in red because this is the only structure function which appears here. So this is the part which appears from the H with H bracket. So this crucially depends on the hypersurface deformation algebra. And again, for this calculation, we just use the classical hypersurface deformation algebra and nothing more. So this is just to see, I know how this spatial metric undergoes gauge transformations given by these, generated by these constraints. How should the lapse and the shift also transform? That's the derivation that I do here. Okay. All right, so this is my favorite picture to denote that we should not get distracted by all the mathematical clutter and keep our eyes on the ball, to say that the big picture is very simple, that I want to introduce some infinitesimal coordinate transformation, and I know how the spatial metric transforms as due to these gauge transformations. So for the line element to be meaningful, that is, to be invariant and coordinate independent, these Ns and Nas must transform in a particular way. And what that particular way is what I just showed you, which depends on the hypersurface deformation algebra, the particular way in which these guys must transform. So in the presence of loop quantum gravity modifications, in particular, I'm going to look at holonomy modifications today, this hypersurface deformation algebra is deformed. So what is the corresponding invariant line element for such spacetimes, such effective spacetimes? That's the question, which I hope to answer in the rest of the talk. Is everything clear up to here? Because this is pretty much the basic idea. Okay, good. All right, so now, of course, we'll simplify things a lot. We'll go to spherical symmetric gravity because we know how to calculate this algebra explicitly only in symmetry-reduced models and not for full gravity. So this is, again, a slide on classical spherical symmetric gravity, but written in terms of these extrinsic curvatures and densitized triads. And this is the classical line element. They are related to these electric fields in this way. Remember that Ex is a scalar, whereas E phi is a density one field. And then I do a spherically symmetric coordinate transformation. And so now I, so this is my coordinate transformation, and they're related to the gauge generators epsilon zero and epsilon x, like so. So this relation is because of how I define my time coordinate with respect to the lapse and shift. So now I insert these coordinate transformations in my line element, and I just collect the coefficients of the dx squared, dt squared, and dx dt. And just for example, the new dt prime will be given like this. So once I do this exercise, I can then read off from the metric what is delta qxx, what is delta nx, and what is delta n. And I find that this is exactly what it should be. I just don't write the full expression because it doesn't give us any more information. Delta nx is exactly what it should be from the expression which I showed you earlier, but now I'm just doing this explicit coordinate transformation and just reading off from this from the line element what it needs to be, and it exactly, of course, matches what it should be for the full GR case. Same with delta n. Again, qxx is the only non-trivial structure function which appears here. There is no q phi phi because of the symmetry of the problem, because we are in spherical symmetric gravity. Yeah, so this is the only structure function which appears in the h with h brackets. So the primes here denote derivatives with respect to x, which is the radial coordinate. Okay, so now let's do some LQG, or at least some effective LQG, which is to introduce this kind of corrections. So the point is that these Fs should be represented by some matrix elements of SU2 holonomies. So they are usually bounded. So they have to be bounded, but they're usually taken to be this kind of sine function. I don't choose them right here because we can keep it arbitrary for our purposes to, you know, allow for quantization ambiguity. So for example, choosing it in some higher spin dimension or something. And then if one calculates the constraint bracket, and this has been done earlier, one finds that the only part of the algebra which changes is the h with h bracket. And now instead of having just, so this is just qxx in this case, you also have like a beta function, which is a function of k phi. So it's related to this holonomy modification function one introduces over here. Again, this choice of this function is not arbitrary, of course. You get it by regularizing the constraint in a very specific way. But it has some quantization ambiguities. So now, when the beta is, so the beta is just given by this, the second derivative of this function, and beta goes to 1 is, of course, the classical limit. So as I already mentioned, the typical choice is to choose some sine function, and then beta is some cosine. And given this deformed algebra, so of course remember the h with d and the d with d brackets are just as they were for classical spherical symmetric gravity, we can now calculate the delta nx, and it pretty much follows the classical calculation, and you find that you get a beta times qxx over here, just as expected. But the transformation of the lapse only depends on the h with d bracket, which does not change over here. So it must keep the same form because it doesn't involve any structure functions, just some structure constants. So beta is the only deformation coming from LQG. So for that to be true, the cancellations require that you do not do coordinate transformation of the classical line element, but of an effective line element which looks like this. So yeah, so this is pretty much the main derivation which I don't show you, but sort of tell you how to go about it. And the point is, if you start with the classical line element and do coordinate transformations after introducing this kind of modifications to the Hamiltonian constraint, then you just find that your results are not consistent. The transformations that delta n and delta nx have are not consistent to give you an invariant line element. The only invariant line element which you can construct once you introduce this kind of holonomy corrections is this one. So beta is, of course, the same deformation function which appears here. Okay, so just let me recap, because this is the main point pretty much. So for the classical hypersurface deformation algebra, we did this kind of a coordinate transformation, and we showed that the invariant line element is coordinate independent only when the lapse and shift transform in a particular way. And then when corrections are introduced in specifically these holonomy corrections from loop quantum gravity, this algebra is deformed, only the H with H brackets. And then to have that the transformations of the spatial metric, the lapse and the shift, are give you a consistent, by consistent I mean a coordinate independent line element, then the only coordinate independent invariant line element that you get is the one which picks up this factor of beta. And this just shows us that how space-time structures are very strongly affected by the same corrections which one introduces to alter dynamics in loop quantum gravity. Because these holonomy modifications are primarily responsible for singularity resolution and so on in not just loop quantum cosmology, but also there's a Schwarzschild space-times. So, but this shows us that the same corrections, if you have to introduce them consistently, then the effective line element that you end up getting already clearly shows us that you have very strong modifications of space-time. How so? Is because, so remember that beta was the second derivative of this holonomy modification function, so this was this cosine function, if you choose it to be sine square something. Or at least if this f is bounded, then the second derivative of beta at the point when f reaches its maximum has to be negative. So that just means that you can immediately read off from this effective line element that there is signature change because the time-time coordinate, time-time component of the metric has positive now because it's like minus beta over there. So the classical singularity is exactly where this function, this holonomy modification function reaches its maximum, and at that point beta must be negative. So just to give you the big picture here, holonomy modifications, of course, imply corrections to the equations of motion. And that would mean that once you have this modified equation of motion, the QXX, the Q phi phi, the spatial metrics picks up some corrections. They're not the same as the classical ones. But those are not the only corrections. The line element itself changes, and it changes by picking up this new factor of beta. So you cannot have that the equations of motions are changed and I derive some new corrections for the metric components, for the spatial metric components, but then ignore this factor of beta in the full line element. Okay, this is going faster than expected. All right, so so this is just for spectral symmetry. What are the implications for other physical systems? So everywhere where such kind of deformations of the algebra, so remember, the only thing I use pretty much is the deformation of the algebra to derive this line element. So everywhere else where this shows up, I would expect that we can have similar line elements. Of course, we haven't done derivations for anything else right now, but we are working on it. And this has been shown in a whole host of systems. For example, in loop quantum cosmology, once you introduce perturbations, this covariant way, you get similar deformations. Of course, the exact form of the beta is different, but it's, again, signature changing. And we worked it out for dilaton gravity, and Schwarzschild is just what I showed you. There's also CGHS black hole models, and so on. So there's a whole host of models which has some inhomogeneities. And when you have some inhomogeneities, then you find that this algebra is deformed as compared to the classical Dirac algebra. Why do you need inhomogeneities for that? Is because, I mean, you have to have a system where this the spatial diffeomorphism constraint is not trivially zero in order to see this, because otherwise the right-hand side is zero. So they don't cause it, but it's necessary to have them to see this effect. So the big statement would be that, you know, holonomy modifications necessarily lead to such deformations of the algebra. So far, we were just looking at what does deformations of the algebra mean for symmetries of this kind of effective or quantum space times. But now, and from there, the sign change in the algebra kind of already told us that there must be signature change. But now you see it more explicitly and cleanly from the metric itself. And but of course, the signature change still resolves classical singularity in the sense of avoiding unbounded curvatures and so on. Because these functions, once they're introduced, you don't have unbounded curvature. So in that sense, singularity is resolved. But there's a new model of quantum space-time because there's no global Riemannian structure. Locally, you either have Euclidean space or Lorentzian space, but there is no global Riemannian structure which you can map this into. And this is an effective theory, so how far should we trust it? Well, the fact is that if you introduce this in the way that you introduce this for expectation values and then add on fluctuations and higher moments of the quantum state, you can show that these kind of corrections, which are generic to any quantum theory, fluctuations and higher moments, they do not affect the algebra. So because they still keep the same algebra as GR, and that's kind of expected because this kind of R square kind of corrections for any higher curvature theory, they share the same Dirac algebra as GR. So because as long as this is general covariant, they all have the same algebra. So that's not an unexpected result. So that just tells us these kind of fluctuations and other kind of higher moments cannot undo these deformations coming from holonomy modifications, for example. Okay, so I told you that there is an Euclidean regime. What more do we know about it? And this is ongoing work. We can write down the Hamiltonian constraint explicitly and introduce these modification functions. I don't give their explicit form over here. And instead of just working with Schwarzschild, or spherical symmetry, one can work with some dilatonic potential, which will cover like other models as well. And then if you plug in this standard choice for the holonomy modification function and expand around its maximum, so this is the point where the classical singularity was, because this is where this function reaches its maximum. If you expand around this point, you find that the curvature-dependent part of the Hamiltonian around that point picks up a negative sign. So this is exactly the same terms as here, but now with some minus sign. But also there's an additional term which appears over here. And what it means is that, of course, first of all, the sign must change for the curvature terms, as it should for any Euclidean gravity model. So now you have Euclidean gravity. But because of this additional sort of potential term, it's not just some instantonic solution or just some reflection of the Lorentzian regime. So this new contribution can be now combined with the original dilatonic potential to give you this additional contribution to the potential. So this is a different model. This is a different space-time compared to the Lorentzian space-time one started with. This is not just a mirror image of the Lorentzian space-time. So of course, if you set delta equals 1, you can show that this change in the potential is identical to the potential for spherical symmetry. So if you start with spherical symmetry in the Lorentzian regime, you end up with twice the potential in the Euclidean regime. Of course, the signature of the curvature terms are also changed. And you can play this game with other things. Like if you start with some, I think, CGHS model, then this ends up being a model with spherical symmetric gravity with cosmological constant because you change the potential in each case. So that's a very, very big difference. It's not just some weak rotation or something which can take this away. And finally, so I do set delta equals 1 just to facilitate this comparison, but like this delta is what in Lucan cosmology will be known as proportional to this area gap. So this delta is somehow going to proportional to this new parameter that comes in to regularize these theories. And that is typically very small, so this makes like some huge contributions. And we're also working on some LQC models where you find that this kind of new perturbative contributions are consistent with a cosmological constant which is proportional to this 1 over length Planck square added to the full Hamiltonian density. So yeah, so long story short, in LQC models, once you add perturbations, you find similar contributions in the Euclidean regime as well. Okay, so this is something which I alluded to earlier, and I'm not going to go into any details for this, but this Dirac algebra is actually a Lie algebraoid, and these people showed recently that you can use some new methods of this what they call this G Gaussian vector fields, which preserve a particular form of the metric, to derive this algebra. So you don't need then the ADM metric, and you don't need to have the usual tools required for ADM. All you need is a good definition of the Lie derivative and a metric. And that would be enough to derive what the hypersurface deformation brackets would be. And what we found is that if you then apply this to this kind of LQG-inspired modifications, let's say, then you find that this beta, as long as it doesn't change sign, can be removed. So by removed, I mean that the brackets, in the brackets with some canonical transformation, you can absorb the beta. Of course, they show up in the equations of motion as well, but at least that means that you have the same structure of space-time as Riemannian geometry. So you can do that, but only as long as the sign of beta does not change. So locally, you can always make the model to have some effective Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian geometry, but But global, there is no global transformation which can take beta away. Again, taking beta away doesn't mean that you don't see any of its effects. Of course, it reappears in the equations of motion. But at least for the structure of space-time, you find that there are these two inequivalent Lie algebroids, which cannot be mapped using any algebraic morphism. So this is this symmetry picture that I was alluding to earlier. But now let's talk of some specific solutions. Because we are in spherical symmetry, so I'm going back to the spherical symmetry model that I was describing. And you can write down the equations of motion for the triad variables and the extrinsic curvatures. I don't write the ones for extrinsic curvatures because they're just very long and not useful for our purposes. But of course, solving them is difficult because these are coupled, nonlinear, partial differential equations. But there are an important class of solutions which can be calculated, and those are the stationary ones. So for stationary solutions, I'd require that the left-hand side of this equation, for example, is zero, as well as that the nx is going to be zero. So in that case, I'm looking for one of the zeros of this function. Again, I don't write them explicitly, so this is some trigonometric function in the usual choice. So one of the zeros is like, so you find that they must be, k phi must be zero, or pi over 2 delta, and so on. So we know that for, if we are outside the horizon far enough, we must match classical space-time. We must have the right classical limit. So k phi must go to zero for in this limit. And there is no smooth way in which k phi can do that. So k phi equals to zero is going to be the classical solution. And then for higher values of this, for the zeros of this function, they are going to indicate some Euclidean regime. So for example, we're just going to look at the first Euclidean regime will correspond to this value. I'm going to make this more explicit later. Of course, if there are Euclidean solutions, stationary has to be generalized because there's no time like killing vector field. So what I mean by is to have imply a solution which has a killing vector transversal to the hypersurface in the 3 plus 1 decomposition. And it would be static if it's normal to the hypersurface. And then there's one additional subtlety. So k phi, a fixed k phi, can correspond to be a gauge condition on an entire region of space-time. For example, outside the Schwarzschild horizon, it's well known that k phi equals zero is a gauge condition for the entire of outside of this space-time. Or inside the horizon, for example, k phi is equals some constant only gives you a unique spatial slice, because inside you can, for the classical case, you can modify, you can look at it as a Kantosky-Sachs model, which is some anisotropic cosmological model. And for that model, so within this homogeneous gauge, k phi equals to constant gives you a unique spatial slice. So what k phi equals constants corresponds to, we have to be careful what that means. And of course, for these dots over here, there are more alternating Lorentzian and Euclidean solutions, perhaps, but we don't know the dynamics. We don't understand the dynamics well enough. So let's just focus on the first Euclidean regime for now and see how far we can go. OK, so outside the horizon is easy. We choose some gauge conditions that one usually does. And you find that you get uniquely the classical Schwarzschild solution. So although I started with some modification functions, you find that these modification functions just go to the classical ones by the requirement that k phi is zero. And you have the usual line element. So now once we are inside the horizon, of course we know that x and t interchanges roles. They exchange roles because x behaves like the time coordinate now. And in this case, k phi equals zero is not a very good choice anymore if the metric is dependent on x, which is the time coordinate. So we need to make some other choices. And of course, also we know that classically the solutions written in terms of these t's can, so now I relabel x as t, and the solution inside can be made to look like this. I mean, this is the classical solution for Schwarzschild. But I choose some suitable gauge, so now I choose again nx is zero, but now I choose some anisotropic version of conformal time, so I just choose square root of ex to be, which is equal to t, that to be the lapse. And then on the black on the left is what you get, what is the classical solutions written in terms of this new conformal time coordinate. And on the right in red is what you get for LQG corrected solutions. So if you look at the left, eta going to zero is the horizon. And eta going to pi is where the singularity is. So that's where these things blow up, some of these blow up, some of these go to zero. Whereas on the right, It's easy to check. So I did not write down the expression for all of them because, again, this is very complicated. But it's easy to check that EX never goes to zero anymore. If I can still go to zero, but it's not harmful because if you calculate, let's say, the Creshmann scalar, you find that all the terms in there are now bounded and they only blow up if delta goes to zero, which is the limit you want them to blow up in, and so on. But of course, this does not tell you enough to say that I understand. So this would be a very nice solution because now you would say that effectively the singularity is resolved, you understand what is going on inside the black hole. But this is not quite true because these solutions cease to be valid at some point when this beta function goes to zero and you have this Euclidean regime. So that's what we want to look at. So inside the horizon, I can actually calculate the beta function. And I can calculate when it goes to minus one, which is this point where the function reaches its maximum. So after this time, when this quantity, so tan of these dots or these things, so when this goes to one, as we can see, so one minus one, so this beta goes to zero. So at this point, you cannot treat eta anymore as some time coordinate, but as a fourth spatial coordinate. But that means that now you switch from an initial value problem to a boundary value problem. And you have to give me additional boundary conditions at this boundary to know what the solutions in the Euclidean regime is going to be. So just for a test case, we assume that k phi increases in the homogeneous interior and ultimately reaches this beta equal to zero point. And I mean, if you assume that k phi keeps increasing in the homogeneous interior and reaches the beta equal to zero point, that's a dynamical solution. But then at this point, at this boundary, you have to assume that, let's say, k phi keeps increasing. And this is an assumption, not at all justified, because I don't know what the appropriate boundary condition should be. But if that does happen, then one can calculate, then one can evolve up to when beta goes to minus one, and then one can calculate what the line element in that case is going to be. So in that case, again, you can choose analogous gauge conditions to the classical case, and you find that the effective line element, of course, as expected, does not have any time coordinate anymore. Now, x equals 2m is not a horizon anymore. This is exactly the boundary between Euclidean and Lorentzian regime. Because if you go beyond x equals 2m, then you find that this would be, if you go below x equals 2m, then you find that both it would have two negative signs. That is meaningless simply because that's not a horizon, but a boundary between this Lorentzian and Euclidean regimes.
Wait, so this is valid both inside and outside?
I know. This is inside, yeah.
So the metric would be only for the inside, anyways. You cannot really talk about the horizon.
Right. But then But once you reach this Euclidean regime and you put me some boundary conditions, you don't know anymore what is where you can go. You don't have a causal diagram anymore. So, I mean, the confusion is because you try to plot this, let's say, on a Penrose diagram, but you don't have time anymore. So where x equals infinity goes, you can put like tau also goes to infinity in the same directions. It's not a causal diagram. It depends on some boundary conditions which you choose at this boundary when you go from Lorentzian to Euclidean.
And the boundary is where? It's at the close to singularity or?
It's at beta equals zero. So it is far inside in the horizon. Up to that point, it's very well defined and you see everything is good. But after that, it's sort of up for grabs. So do not take this solution very literally at all. This is just to show that there is some solution which you get an effective line element, which is Euclidean. But I don't claim in any seriousness that this is a solution you should trust. Because for a trustworthy solution, you need some appropriate boundary condition at this boundary, which I don't know what they are. Okay, so I think I did well within time. So the conclusions are that introducing quantum gravity corrections is fun and nice, and it gives you all sorts of very interesting corrections to equations of motion. But the same corrections also give you new space-time structures. And these have to be taken into account for a consistent picture. And sometimes they can be more subtle than just, let's say, if you just look at the equation of motion, you might think that there's just a bounce or something, but that might not be true if you look at the space-time structure and you might have some regime change from Lorentzian to Euclidean. And as I showed you, that the only consistent effective line element, so for specific line element solutions, it's difficult to do because you don't know what this boundary condition should be, but you can derive what consistent line elements should be, and you see that you get an Euclidean one when holonomy effects are strong. So when beta is negative, you get a line element which has to be necessarily Euclidean. That we do know. So only boundary value problems are well deposed in this region. And this is just a side note because I did not talk about this at all, but what we find is that this kind of deformations are maybe generic to other approaches as well. So if, for example, if one works with non-commutative geometry, non-commutative gravity, then one can, at least in the Moyle-Weil case, one can show that this kind of deformed diffeomorphisms lead to an algebra which looks very similar to the classical Dirac algebra, but now you have everything replaced by star products in there, which means that they are very non-local. So these kind of deformations are more generic than just to loop quantum gravity. So if you introduce some corrections in some form or another, or some other manifold which is not even continuous, as in non-commutative geometry, you still can calculate these brackets because you don't need ADM methods anymore, thanks to these mathematicians who worked out how to do this otherwise. And that's what we applied, and then you find that there are deformations to general covariance even in this case. Okay, so looking ahead, what we would like to do is, of course, there are two things. One is that you can now apply these methods to loop quantum cosmology. And the first thing to note is that sometimes it was interpreted that this kind of signature change are instabilities in matter or metric perturbations on an otherwise Lorentzian manifold. But that kind of is ruled out because you find that, so again, this derivation is not done, but it should go exactly the way the spherical symmetry one went, then you can derive an invariant line element, and the only one which would be consistent with the symmetry of the system, in the sense of the algebra of the system, has to have some Euclidean line element in the strong holonomy regions. So this is something that we are working on, but then we find some interesting consequences of that. So if you do include signature change, then you find that this recent results that, for example, one cannot have a no boundary state because you have this unsuppressed perturbations, you have this inverse Gaussian weighting with perturbations, they go away because you can have a no boundary state in loop quantum cosmology now if you introduce this dynamical signature change because these perturbations have the correct weighting now. Well, for anyone who knows the problems, the branch cuts on the lapse function on the real line actually get rotated to the imaginary line. So that's why it makes this no boundary state compatible now, and maybe loops and signature change can rescue that. Anyway, I stop here.
What's the nature of your metric, the deformed metric? Is it a Riemann metric with a parameter, or is it a Finzel metric?
Sorry, I couldn't hear the...
What's
the nature of the metric, and you said it's a Riemann metric?
Riemannian metric with a parameter delta, or what is it, a Finzel metric? What kind of metric?
That depends on the... when we look for explicit solutions, for example, in this case, for stationary solutions, it, of course, depends on this parameter delta. But then you have two different regimes when it can be like Euclidean or Lorentzian. And you don't have like, you cannot map it globally to a Riemannian
metric. It's just a normal metric.
It is still a normal metric. It's just.
That depends on the parameter, that's it.
It depends on the parameter delta, but also beta. Beta depends on delta itself. So it's not two parameters. Beta is just a function of this KFIs, which depends on delta as well. But at some point, this changes sign, and then you have Euclidean and Lorentzian regimes. Yeah.
What is the metric doing where it changes signature? Is it continuous there, or what?
Yeah, so that at the point where it is continuous there, but it is degenerate. Like, so some of the time component goes to zero. So it's a metric of two dimensions.
Okay, so you talked about fluctuation. So how do you handle, say, a scalar field or any other kind of fluctuation? Do you have well-defined equations of motion, or fields at that point?
Right. So the equations of motion for, let's say, a scalar field goes from hyperbolic to elliptic.
Yeah, but what about at that point where the metric is degenerate?
No,
yeah.
The solution still diverges as it approaches that surface.
Right. So when it approaches that surface.
The solution diverges as it approaches that surface because the acceleration is slow. What point is it, 0 or infinity? So you can't solve for the. No, regularly.
Sorry.
Sorry, what?
Sorry,
go ahead. So I would say that, if you're saying your GTI is 0 goes to 0 and GTT goes to 0,
you
can't solve for any field fluctuations on top of that. Your accelerations will diverge as you approach.
Right, so you cannot do this. So at that point, if you stick to the Lagrangian theory, then this determinant of the action is not well defined anymore. But what you can do is work everything in the using just Hamiltonian constraints, and everything is well defined in Hamiltonian theory. So if you have an observable corresponding to this corresponding to scalar field, for example, you have an equation which is so this is a mixed type equation. It's hyperbolic on one side and elliptic on the other. So you need to solve this trichomy problem to solve for this. So you go back to this question of what are appropriate boundary conditions so that you can transfer from this Lorentzian to Euclidean regime. But there is nothing which says that there are none. I don't know of one yet, that's true. But that doesn't mean there are none.
I think there's a contradiction between what you're saying, what Keith is saying. I mean, he's saying the equation Laplace, even in the Lorentzian regime, if I understood.
As
you approach that.
Yeah, as you approach that surface, sure.
But on the other side, you don't have, so that's assuming that you have a time coordinate on the other side, right? Otherwise, you don't have propagation. From the Lorentzian side, if you approach. No, it doesn't. I mean, people have calculated power spectrum.
I mean, this is a well-known problem in certain high derivative and classical GR problems. If you try to do the signature chain, you can build from it. Now, maybe you've made some breakthrough that everybody's missed for decades.
Yeah, but
so you buried the lead.
Yeah, the thing is that you in this case, we are trying to rederive what the effective metric looks like in these regimes, right? But in general, you don't have a well-defined Lagrangian theory for the full evolution. That's why we work with effective constraints which are modified. And in that case, the observables are well-defined and their dynamical equations are well-defined.
But just to get the claim straight, so you're saying that using some sort of Hamiltonian methods, not trying to write down an equation of motion directly, say the Klein-Gordon equation. Even though one can't write that down in an unambiguous way, at the place where the signature changes, you're saying there's another way that can get you past that? Is that what you're saying, that there's a well-defined equation of motion? I mean, whether or not you need boundary conditions in the interior is a different question, but is the equation of motion even well-defined in the region where the signature changes?
So
you're saying it is, but I'm just trying to understand.
So it is not, it's not just, so that equation changes from hyperbolic to elliptic, if that's what you mean. So it's not an equation of motion in the elliptic part.
I'm not asking about that, but is there a well-defined partial differential equation?
Yes, there's a well-defined partial.
Even at the point where the metric degenerates?
Yes. And this is not work by me, but this is already shown by other people, that you can do this for cosmology, for example. You have a mixed-type partial differential equation.
Because naively, you'll get into trouble, because the Klein-Gordon equation involves the inverse of the metric. If you write it down, it's the inverse of the metric.
Yeah, the metric.
Maybe partial A, partial B.
That's right. So the metric.
The inverse is blowing up, so one has to give.
But the metric is not defined at that point. So the metric is only defined in the Lorentzian and the Euclidean regimes, where beta is not zero.
Yeah.
So that's why I say that the Lagrangian theory is not well defined everywhere, but the Hamiltonian theory is. So if you don't need the metric, if you want to just work with the constraint.
The equation is in some form at that point.
I don't have it right here, but I can for sure show it to you afterwards. Because as I said, I didn't derive it.
Is it in the end just some partial differential equation?
Or yeah, mixed type partial differential equation, yes.
Yeah, so it'd be nice to see what that partial differential equation is.
Yeah. I can for sure show you.
So similar questions arrive in horizon topology changing space-time. There's generally some ambiguity, as far as I know, always at best some ambiguity in what the equation says at such a point. You have your whole surface, which is even naively seems even worse than a single point where the metric degenerates.
Don't you need to know, so maybe you've mentioned this, but if the hyperbolic equation becomes elliptic, then presumably you need the like boundary conditions at that surface to solve the elliptic equation.
Yeah.
Right? So is that regular? Like,
We don't know what the boundary conditions should be. We need some, I know that, but I don't know what it
is. But I mean, isn't this this related to this question? Because
yeah. So it is. There is an equation, but I don't know how to solve it everywhere.
There's a one side of the problem, and there's a problem. If I continue through, can I do so? Well, at a minimum, in a unique fashion, and then otherwise it's a Cauchy surface, and I don't know what I'm doing. Or at least that's the traditional classical answer.
Sorry, but I didn't get what you were saying.
So there were two different issues. One is, in a one-sided limit, if I approach it, does it diverge or not? That's one. The question is, if that's okay for some reason, then if I try to continue through, then okay, it becomes elliptic, and I now need to specify boundary conditions. If that's not unique, then the evolution is not unique, and now I've got a transitive surface into a Cauchy surface, and
yeah. So the answer to the first question is that yeah, it doesn't diverge. But the answer to the second question is that once you're in this region, you're right that this determinism, in the sense of like you give me some initial data and I know exactly what the interior of a black hole looks like, for example, that's not true anymore. You need some additional boundary conditions.
But these additional boundary conditions are somewhere in the interior. They're not.
Right.
Not at the horizon or whatever you call this.
No, probably somewhere in the future of this.
So I think I think there's two sets of questions.
Right.
One is there a well-defined partial differential equation at all at the horizon? And then the other one is if it's in fact is well-defined and you can decide whether any given function is a solution or not. Then you can ask, can I make this solution unique by imposing boundary conditions somewhere in the interior? And that's a radical change to physics, so we don't know exactly whether we want it to be unique or whether, I mean, we just don't.
Even if we want it to be unique, I don't know if we can make it to be unique in this theory.
Yeah. I'm asking a more sort of.
So for the black hole case,
the question was just about whether the equation is
right. Right. So for the black hole case, there are additional difficulties when you try to add matter, but you can do the same calculation for cosmological perturbations, for example. And in that case, you do have an equation for a scalar matter, let's say, on top of these kind of backgrounds, and it is well defined and it doesn't diverge. I can show you that equation. Black holes have other problems.
In the black hole case, one doesn't know yet.
So black holes have.
Or not, there's a well defined partial differential equation.
So the black holes are difficult because in this case you have non perturbative inhomogeneity. So if you try to add matter, the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraint obeys a different algebra than the gravitational part, which is bad because then you cannot combine them to give like a total. Hamiltonian constraint, which obeys the same algebra. So there are some obstructions in the matter for black holes.
In the cosmological case, are you allowing spatial inhomogeneities also in the scalar field?
Yeah.
It's arbitrary scalar field.
Right. So it's not mini superspace. It's like you have to have some inhomogeneity.
And you claim that in that case, differential equation is well defined.
Right. So if you just have like a background, like if you just have mini superspace, then you don't see any of this, right? Because you don't have, I mean, the D is zero, so the right-hand side is zero. You don't see any of these effects. In order to see anything, you need to have some inhomogeneities.
And you allow arbitrary inhomogeneity for the perturbative?
Linear perturbation theory.
Linear perturbation.
Again, I did not do that, but there are equations for that, I can show you.
Is the space-time interpretation of these possible? Like
right.
Beta that depends on the extrinsic curvature.
That's true, yeah.
And everything. So. The hypersurface and so on.
Yeah, so that is a good point. I mean, I intrinsically made this assumption that once you introduce these corrections, there is still some effective space-time description. So if that is not true, then gauge transformations don't even have to give you space-time coordinate freedom or anything like that. But usually, typically, it is expected that after you do, at least in effective LQG, you have some space-times. So, and it is well-defined in the Lorentzian part. I mean, it's not just well-defined, it's very tame in the Lorentzian part. You have the same space-time structure with some, let's say, dressed metric or something like this, but...
From the dynamical perspective, can you write down some space-time, Lagrangian with the modified symmetries and so on?
Yeah.
Conceivable or?
It is conceivable, except at this point where signal change happens. I don't know how to write down the Lagrangian at that point. But otherwise, you can, in both these regions, write down Lagrangians, which are, yeah. So the Hamiltonian theory is very regular everywhere. But the Lagrangian, unfortunately, because of the determinant of metric appearing, it's slightly less, it's more tricky. So it is not available to us when beta is zero. But other than that, every other point, you can write down Lagrangian theory. Effectively.
In terms of G minimum instead of Q and K, Q and pi.
You go back, you do the inverse. Yeah, you can do that. In fact, one of these, like when you try to do this using algebra, you see that you can absorb this beta into the normal of the spatial hypersurfaces, and then everything becomes Riemannian. Of course, the normal is not normal anymore. It's not normalized because it has a factor of beta in it. But as long as beta is positive, you can do this fully. So in fact, you can. Try to do this the other way around, and that's what we did is, let's say you have just GR, but you take a non-standard normal, and then you do these calculations, and you find that you get this kind of spurious beta factors appearing from now the algebra, but also like it cancels with time, so that you get a GR equation.
But beta, if I understood well, depends on the extrinsic curve.
Right.
So...
But for each...
It's not just a function, it's a... Depends on
but for each hypersurface, it's a given value. So your normal changes everywhere, not just like direction, but also magnitude. But it's still very well posed in this picture of algebra. It's...
Right, there is no question. It's fine.